Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Pete and I are off on another one of our walks down the Wolverhampton Canals. We're actually standing in the middle of a field right now because it's nice and quiet here and it's very sunny. And today's topic is the beloved. And we were going to start off, Pete's going to read one of his favourite poems of Rumi's called Choose Love.
Choose love. Because of the beloved, my heart is happy, my soul illuminated. From the beloved's greenery, hundreds of blessed rivers are flowing to the rose gardens. In order to enter into your rose garden, the soul makes peace with the thorns. Choose love, choose love. Without this beautiful love, life is nothing but a burden.
Okay, wonderful poem. I liked the bit about the thorns. So tell us your thoughts about that poem.
This is Rumi's method. Choose love. That's Rumi's method, choose love. And he's saying choose love as the object of your meditation. You know, we've talked about how meditation needs an object at least to start with. There's something which consciousness focuses on at the beginning. You know, self-inquiry, of course, outlines the territory of meditation as being interiority, as being what goes on inside, what happens in inner space. So yoga is what happens in inner space. And choose love is saying, if the emotion of love is present in your inner space, there you go. Rumi is recommending it as your object. And for Rumi's a Sufi. He's not the only Sufi to talk about love in this fashion. And Sufis, of course, are mostly religious. So it's like they're looking for union with God. So it's like the love of God.
Yeah.
But Rumi points out for us in these songs of heresy that what matters for this method is the emotion of love. And for him, the whole thing was set off by his love for another human being.
Although often when we say the word the beloved, we don't mean like a love affair for a particular person. It's like a much bigger than that. But in this particular instance, Rumi was talking about a person, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was talking about Shamsi Tabriz, who's a kind of crazy dervish. And at the time when Rumi met Shams, he was a big spiritual teacher. He got thousands of followers. They'd come from all over the world to sit at his feet. I mean, you know, this is in the it's a long time ago. It's 13th century, I think. But he was a big deal, and Shams was this kind of ragged tramp, basically. Yeah. You know. Wandering dervish.
Yeah.
But Rumi discerned the interiority of Shams, which was absolutely vast. You know, Shams had a massively expanded consciousness. Mm-hmm. I do. And Rumi was able to see this, and he kind of fell in love.
Yeah.
With Shams, and they did. It seems to me like a very human. Love affair. And the thing is there that Rumi saw that human love for another, erotic love for another, is the paradigm for love for the cosmic beloved.
Yeah.
So there he's pointing out there's something in human life that most of us are going to have some acquaintance with. That's this massively powerful opportunity. Of course, the other thing about that kind of love is that the beloved might get on his camel and bugger off, which Shams did.
Aww.
And Rumi writes about this again in these suppressed poems.
Yeah.
Which have kind of come to light, would have been published recently. The main corpus of, by the way, the main corpus of Rumi's poems doesn't, some of this erotic material is excluded, or heretical material is excluded.
Yeah.
But Shams did get on his camel, and Rumi writes about it, and he was utterly bereft. And suffered the pain of separation to the highest degree. So you've got two things there, you know, union with the beloved and the pain of separation.
Yeah.
But you have the rose garden and the thorns.
Yeah.
And in the poem I read out, of course, Rumi says, embrace it all, choose it all. If you choose love, you choose the rose garden of love, but you choose the thorn of the roses as well.
Yeah.
And separation and oneness with the beloved in ecstatic happiness are one and the same. They belong together, mutually dependent. And it's a very important thing that Rumi's saying there. Separation is painful. Separation from the beloved is painful. It's yearning. But what Rumi is pointing out there in the poem is that the yearning, the thorns, the absence of the beloved is still dependent on the beloved. And he's saying you can actually use it, you know. The object of your meditation is love. You can use it. You can use that dark side of love, the pain of separation, just as much as you can use the joy of love. Another Sufi, whose name escapes me, drew attention to the same point when he talked about how in despair you might cry out. For Allah, you know, you might cry out for Allah. And he said that one day what happened to him, he was crying out for Allah, and he actually Allah decided to talk to him and said, "He said every time your cry of despair for me is uttered and comes out of your breast in all its anguish and pain, but there I am. Your cry of separation is the presence of me.
Yes.
The cry of separation is the presence of the beloved.
And that's remember many years ago, you saying that to me. And I think that was one of the things that really kicked off a massive change, an internal change for me, was that sentence.
I'm such a bastard.
Yeah. Because I've just been, did a podcast on crying yoga.
Yes, you did.
And I think, just to extend a bit on that, is exactly what you said. Mm. It's like when you reach into the pain and you draw it out and it comes out in sort of voice and sobbing, it almost, when you're really into it and when it's going to have the most releasing effect is when that cry for the wholeness and the, you know, the defragmentation that trying to bring about, that cry, that yearning is the thing itself.
Yeah.
And it's all like when you could become one with the cry.
Yeah.
That's when things release.
Yeah.
And it's really impossible to describe it.
Yeah.
As well as I would like. But that sentence that you said, so many years ago, I think I've just remembered it ever since, and that's that's how I really got into places inside myself that I hadn't been able to reach before.
Mm. Of course, it flips, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It flips into the drunkenness and the ecstasy and the intoxication.
Yeah.
Which is the other metaphor they use, you know, the metaphor of wine. That this meditation on the powerful emotion of love, whether that's the actual presence of the beloved and the oneness with the beloved, the lovemaking with the beloved on the one hand, or the absence of the beloved on the other. The thing about a beloved, of course, is a beloved can always at least potentially leave.
Yeah.
And again, in Rumi's case, Shams went. In fact, Shams was assassinated.
Oh no!
Apparently, by Rumi's disciples, who were jealous.
Oh well, that's a big pile of shit.
Oh. Oh no, such is life, eh?
Oh man.
You know, such is life. I mean, we don't know for sure. It was a long time ago. It was 800-900 years ago. You know, but we don't know for sure. But it seems like. But Shams did disappear. Shams, that's the word, it means the sun. He's like the sun.
Oh, yeah.
He's like the sun in the sky, the sun of Tabriz.
Yeah.
Because he was kind of a luminous, very luminous person in rags. So, yeah, we also get the metaphor of intoxication and drunkenness, because being in love, you know, that how drunk you feel when you're in love. Your body's like kicking out all these hormones to get you to make babies and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
All the oxytocin and phenylethylamine and dopamine and DMT and endorphins. You know, his body gets flooded with love chemicals, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it's an intoxication. And again, this Rumi particularly, but the Sufis in general, did talk about wine, the wine of love, and the intoxication of love. And like our countercultural yogis that we were talking about the other day, the followers of Shiva, the god of intoxication, understood exactly the same thing. You know, that there's an intoxicated quality to the most powerful emotion that can act as meditative rocket fuel. But of course, in Rumi's context, because Rumi was operating in the context of Islam, although it's rather a different Islam from our modern Islam, it seems it's generally fairly liberal. But then, as now, alcohol is forbidden in Islam. So, this use of a metaphor of drunkenness and of wine is self-consciously heretical. The point there is that dogmatic adherence to any kind of creed is an obstacle to the free-flowing emotion of devotion to the beloved. And this is why Rumi very often takes a little pop at it, you know.
So I'd just like to say something a bit more about separation, because all those years ago when you talked about the beloved, like many things that you said early on in our relationship, I thought to myself, oh, that sounds good. Don't know what it means. But yeah, okay, let's just have a look at that. Sounds interesting. Sounds like it could be useful. Sounds exciting to explore, so I did, and gave it a thorough testing out, as I do with everything you say, and all students should do this. Anything your teacher says, okay, that's interesting, well, I'm not going to believe a word of that until I've thoroughly tested it out for myself. And that's what I did, and it took me quite a long time to really understand what you meant when you said the beloved. And this is my experience of it. The first time I had what I call a yogic blowout, where suddenly the lid popped off and a lot of the tensions and stresses in my body, in my mind, in my body mind melted away, I felt that those tensions were separating me from the beloved.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost like this thick, painful barrier between whatever I am and whatever the beloved is. And when they've gone, I felt this overwhelming, painful joy.
Mm-hmm.
again, a bit like intoxication, as you were describing earlier on, of sounds a bit of a cliche to say, one with the beloved, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And that, to me, when you use the word beloved, that's what I feel that you mean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, this is what he meant.
Yeah, it's the rose and the thorns.
Yeah, yeah.
Rumi's got this other little admonition. And he advised his own students to be like an innkeeper that keeps a wayside inn somewhere out in the sticks, but you know, on the trade route, on the Silk Road or something like that.
Yeah.
And he said, be like this innkeeper, and whoever passes by, invite them in with a smile, even if they be a crowd of sorrows.
Oh.
And he was very much into embracing, in as much as he could, the entirety of human experience. And as the, it's almost wrong to say this, as the object of your meditation, because it's not really an object, is it? Yeah. But as your central concern in your self-inquiry, you want to put it in a dry language.
Yeah.
Or in a poetic, juicy, wet language.
Yeah.
In your love affair with life, let life itself be what matters in the love affair of your life. And that is meditation, and that is, inverted commas, spirituality. And Rumi was particularly good for that. And of course, when one is one with the beloved, one is love. Yeah, that is it is. That's what it is. Yeah. And you do have this sense that the root layer of existence itself, whether macrocosmic or microcosmic, is love. The protons love the electrons.
Yeah.
The quantum vacuum loves the virtual particles. Mm-hmm. The Shiva loves the Shakti. And so on. And you do, I mean, you can only have a kind of a ridiculous stab at describing it. You can't come up with a mathematical proof or anything like that. Or even a good argument, but that is just reporting that that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
And you just describe it in your own way, that same thing.
And it was particularly amazing that when the lid popped off, I was actually crying. And exactly what you said, I felt the beloved in my cry for the beloved.
Yeah.
Actually, it was just there.
That's right, yeah.
It leapt in. The whole universe just leapt into that cry.
Yeah. Rumi, of course, was an amazingly talented poet, so he was able to give us some pointers through his expression of his own experiences with this. And particularly when it was very raw, with this concrete, real love affair with Shams, who was his lover and his guru. Yeah, so it was all kind of a bit unrespectable, really. And of course, at this time, you know, Rumi is this kind of big deal. You know, he's this world famous spiritual teacher.
Yeah.
And he goes and has this thing with this nutter, and it kicks him even further into orbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he describes it as a descent into drunkenness, you know. And part despair, part delirious intoxication. So you see, for Rumi, everything's an opportunity. It's the thing, the it, as we call it, is there. It's here. It's right now. It's not an attainment. It's not a mountain to climb. It's right here. And in fact, again, in one of these Songs of Heresy, one of these repressed poems, Rumi does in fact state as much, and I'll read it. It's called Search There. Sometimes you get as frightened as a camel. Sometimes you get stuck in the mud like hunted prey. Oh, young fool, how long will you keep running away from yourself? In the end, the thing will happen anyway. Just go in the direction where there is no direction. Go, search there.